Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that dares you to think outside the box of convention. And boy, I am not letting you down today. I'm so thrilled to have Philip Mantle on. Now, before I go ahead with the show, I just want to refer back to 2 weeks ago when he was supposed to be on, and my entire neighborhood, for as far as the eye could see, went into complete darkness. The phones were out, the computer was out, and I said to myself, well, okay, I don't want to be paranoid, but it just seems like every time I go to this place, something seems to go wacky on the electrical units. Philip was patient, even though I think he was a bit disgruntled at not even hearing from me. The lights and electricity were out for 5 hours, but he's agreed to come back today, and we're going to kick ass because we are going to talk about the Alien Autopsy Casebook, which is his latest book, and you know, I can't wait to talk to them about this because a lot of us have just kind of brushed off the alien autopsy since the propaganda convinced us that it was a hype. So without a lot of ado, although I can't do justice to Philip if I don't introduce him as one of the true researchers of note in the UFO ET field. He's a pluri-published author. He publishes a magazine called UFO Matrix. This man is extremely qualified. He has the gift of amazing research and experience. And so I would like to now welcome him. Hello, Philip.
Good evening.
Thanks again for being patient. I really am sorry for what happened last time, and I'm glad you're here.
No need to apologize. Not your fault.
No, it really wasn't. I was sitting here in total distress. I thought this is the time it would be good to be an alcoholic. I just get to All right. Well, listen, Phil, we've got a lot to talk about, so I won't chit-chat because there is so much. I don't really know where to start. I think the best place is just to quickly ask you to tell us about your background as much as possible, putting that into a concise little ball of information so that we don't spend the whole hour talking about the incredible work you've done.
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, Patricia, I, as far back as I can remember, even as a young boy, was always interested in all things that I would call paranormal in inverted commas. You know, when colleagues at school during the holidays, they would go off here, there, and everywhere, I would go to the spiritualist church with a friend and his mum and his grandmother. And, you know, I used to do talks at high school about, you know, poltergeists and paranormal phenomena of every description.
That's wonderful.
That sort of it. Yeah, so in conjunction with that, I was also fascinated by astronomy. I was a member later in life of the various astronomical groups here in the UK. But then in sort of the late 1970s, I was in the west of England with a friend, and we went to visit a chap who had built his own observatory. And that particular evening, I can't remember now whether it was cloudy or whatever, but we couldn't use the telescope. I was reading a book. I do not know the title of it, but it had one chapter on UFOs, basically dismissing them, although not entirely. And it mentioned a town called Warminster in Wiltshire. And apparently in the 1960s, early 70s, there had been a lot of UFO sightings there. So we literally had nothing better to do. And we were only, you know, about 20 miles from this town. So off we went in the car, found the local vantage point, which was called Cradle Hill, stuck ourselves there, met an elderly gentleman, no idea who he was at the time. And lo and behold, we saw some strange lights. Now, nothing fantastic, and with a bit of hindsight, they were probably military flares, because it's a big military area as well. But nonetheless, that sparked the interest. And in this book was an address for the British UFO Research Association. I extremely naively wrote to them and thought they could supply me with all the answers I wanted to know. Of course, they couldn't. And I was always that type of person, Patricia. I wasn't satisfied with someone telling me. I wanted to find out myself.
That's great.
And that's how I became, you know, fixated, if you like, on UFOs. Again, purely by chance, there was a small piece in a local newspaper here about two brothers called Mark and Graham Birdsall, who were setting up their own UFO organisation in the city of Leeds, which is in the north of England. And it was, again, only about 5 miles from where I lived. I went along to their meetings and became hooked. And the rest, as they say, is history.
And of course, you are in the region, one of the hotspot regions on the planet for all things paranormal, right? I mean, let's talk about the sacred triangle of Glastonbury, Avebury, and Stonehenge. And I imagine that you've spent a lot of time in that space.
I mean, I live quite a distance from those areas, but they are, as you said, you know, one of the epicenters of all things spiritual in the world. It's one of my most favourite parts of the whole of the UK. And I was there just last year. We'll probably end up there again at some point this year. For those that's never been, it's a beautiful part of the country, irrespective of what you're interested in, from the ancient monuments to the grand houses. There is something for everyone. But I live in the north of England, and we're slightly different. But again, here we have standing stones, nothing as grand as Stonehenge, but we still have them. We have stone circles. The capital of the county where I live is called York, supposedly one of the most haunted places on the planet Earth.
Wow.
The title York is from the Viking name Jorvik. The Romans were there, the Saxons, the Normans. I mean, you name it. It's a walled city. There is a Norman fortification all the way around the city. And, of course, it's had its fair share of UFO sightings as well. And just outside of the county, of the city, we have the Yorkshire Dales National Park, a very beautiful part of the world. And, yes, I am biased.
But you've got the bogs there, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the Pennine Hills run down the north of England. And for whatever reason, Patricia, again, with all things paranormal, including the UFO subject, we have our fair share of UFO sightings, paranormal phenomena, and so on, in certain areas within the Pennine chain. So, you know, we're very fortunate.
Yeah, well, I want to say right off the bat that I'm thrilled that you are also into the paranormal, because your research is so scientific, and you've got this beautiful balance of the intuitive and logical brain, and that's right up my alley, being a person who is focused on extra-dimensional communication. So it's all good, as they say. Let's get to your incredible book, Alien Autopsy. Woo! I love this book. And I'd like to just introduce people, for those of you who aren't aware, that the Alien, correct me if I'm wrong, by the way, the Alien Autopsy film was supposedly filming one of the bodies that was retrieved from the Roswell crash, which is a subject that is extremely interesting to me, the big daddy of UFO events. And so I think I've talked about this a lot on the show, and I would really like to delve into that, to leap in, if we may, so that we can cover it with the time we've got. All righty?
Absolutely. I mean, the man behind the Alien Autopsy film, of course, is a chap called Ray Santilli. Ray's a businessman in London. And in 1993, he contacted me. I was part of the British UFO Research Association. And initially, he said he was interested in making a UFO documentary. Would we be interested? So, yeah, maybe. At some point further down the line, he said, well, actually, Philip, I have film of the Roswell UFO crash. And I have film of the bodies, plural, bodies of some of the creatures from that craft being autopsied. Are you interested?
Yeah.
So I live 200 miles north of London. So I said, well, show me, basically. Yeah, it's a great story. He told me how he'd been in Cleveland, Ohio, looking for old footage of Elvis and so on. And he bought a piece of Elvis film from an elderly gentleman. And the old boy said, well, before I was in the, you know, before I filmed Elvis, I was in the military and I filmed Roswell. And hey, presto, they shook on a deal. And I said, well, show me. So the story went, yes, I can. No, I can't. Yes, I can. And this went on for about a year and a half. I met Ray Santilli in London in the meantime when the movie Fire in the Sky came out. We were hosting a lecture by Travis Walton and Mike Rogers. And he told me the story again. And I said, well, show me. Yes, I will. So it came to 1995. So, you know, we'd known about this for about a year and a half. And there was a Roswell movie made by Paul Davids coming out here on video. And I rang Santilli and said, look, do you still claim to have this footage? I basically dismissed it. And he says, yes. So I said, well, show me. So he said, okay, speak to my secretary. arrange an appointment and come and see it. So I did, went to London, and over the next 2 or 3 months, I was shown autopsies of two different creatures, another one in a tent, and some debris film. Now, at the time, I was also Bufora's conference organizer, and we had an event already planned and booked for August of 1995, already done. So just off the top of my head, I said to Santilli, will you show this at the conference? And he said, yes, if you'll help me investigate it, Philip. We shook hands, and by chance, the information got out into the public domain. The press went absolutely mad. And that's when the various television companies around the world became involved. And in August, Ray showed it at our conference, which was a huge sellout. And just 2 days later, the film was shown around the world. In the United States, it was on Fox, of course, and you know countless other other countries as well. And it's usually controversial, and I just kept at it, you know, and investigating it ever since.
So you were, in essence, one of the first people to see this footage.
Absolutely. I mean, there was myself. There was the pop singer called Reg Presley. He's the lead singer with the 60s band The Troggs. He's a friend of Santilli's and also very interested in UFOs and crop circles. And a friend of his was Colin Andrews, who was a well-known crop circle researcher at the time, and myself. And we were the first three to see it. A colleague by the name of Maurizio Baiata from Italy.
I know all these people.
Yeah, Maurizio came over slightly after to see it. There was a public screening in April of 1995 at the London Museum, but that was on invitation only. There was a lot of press there, but there was a lot of researchers there as well. But again, that was invitation only. Nick Pope was there and various other luminaries. And, you know, the place just went wild. I mean, my phone wouldn't stop ringing because they could find me. Okay, I was in the phone book, but Ray Santilli... He was just a man in London. I mean, you know, he had no business phone number or anything. So they came via me first. So what we would do every now and again, I mean, I was on very friendly terms with Ray. I thought that once we got the film out into the public domain, Patricia, a number of things may happen. One was that someone would come forward and say, actually, Philip, it's a fake. I'm one of the actors, or I was the cameraman, or, you know, I bought the props for it.
Sure.
Alternatively, if someone would come forward and say, well, no, it's real. My father or my grandfather told me about it, and he's one of the people that was involved, or some other such scenario, Patricia. But absolutely nothing. No people came forward to say it's a fake, it's genuine, you know, or anything in between. So myself, colleagues throughout Europe and other parts of the world did what we could, tried to investigate it as the best we could. And every now and again, I would you know, pester Santilli for some more information. And he made it quite clear from the beginning, he looked upon this as a commercial product. He wanted to make money out of it. And, you know, he was, and that was it. He never made any secret of that. I mean, that's what he did for a living. He was a commercial animal in that respect. And it took an awful long time and a lot of research, a lot of headaches, a lot of traveling up and down the motorway and a lot of correspondence, which all eventually ended up in the book, Alien Autopsy Casebook. It took 14 years worth of work to hopefully, get to the bottom of it.
And you feel you have gotten to the bottom of it?
Well, you know, I'm pretty confident. There's a piece of film that we call the tent footage that I don't think has been seen on television, certainly in the West.
Basically, I've never heard about the tent footage until I started reading your book.
Yeah, it was the first piece of film that Santilli showed to anyone. And all you have is, he claimed that when they got on site in Roswell, they set up a field tent and one of the creatures was put in there on a temporary measure. And the cameraman set up his tripod and filmed a few minutes of it. It was poor quality. So what you see is a creature lying on a slab or a table covered by the white blanket, but you can see the head and the hands and the feet sticking out. To the far side, there are two men in white coats, seem to have a knife or a scalpel in their hand. There's a fleshy tissue they're handling. And every now and again, there's a man in a dark coat, moves in front of the camera. You don't see his face. It lasts for about 7 or 8 minutes. Now, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, a gentleman came forward and said, I know something about this piece of film. Bear in mind, this hadn't been shown on television. And he said, I was at a company that does animations. They claim to have made it. So he told me who these people were. I tracked them down. And the owner was a gentleman by the name of Keith Bateman. Now, to begin with, Keith would not talk to us, wouldn't have anything to do with us. So I left him alone, but slowly but surely managed to coax him out of the woodwork. And he told us a little bit of information and a little bit more, and eventually told us the whole lot. He claims they used to have brainstorming sessions. And he worked not for Sam Tilley, but with him on projects. And someone was in the office reading a book, and it mentioned Roswell. And Keith said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had a piece of Roswell footage? They all laughed. So he went off to a farm and made the tent footage. And he ran it through the computer and aged it and darkened it and all this kind of thing. So originally it was filmed in colour. Now it had been converted to black and white. He went to Sam Tilley's London office and showed him, what do you think of this? And Sam Tilley basically said, yeah, it's okay, but it's not good enough. We would need something more graphic. So Keith went away and got a quote from a special effects house to make something much more graphic. And the quote was £45,000. Sam Tilley says, that's too much, go away. So we've got our first chink in the armour, if you like, and Keith told us all this. We have him on film, we have him on tape. He went public with some of that in a national newspaper here, but didn't tell the whole story. And Sam Tilley said, well, we disowned that part of the film. He claimed that he'd been hoodwinked by Keith Bateman. He claimed, I gave Keith some film to transfer onto video for me. Unbeknown to me, the film was ruined. And he concocted this piece of film and passed it off as the real McCoy. It's only then when you look into Keith's equipment that he had at the time, he was an animator on computers. They didn't have any telecine equipment. They didn't have any equipment to transfer it from 16mm film to video in the first place. And Sam Tilley knew that. So there was the first chink in the armour. But Sam Tilley still said, you know, the main autopsy film, of which there is two, by the way, there are two different ones. Only one has been shown on television. I've seen them both. He still maintained it. He said that keeps its integrity. Again, when Keith Bateman went public with the information about the tent footage, we thought, well, if the rest of it's a fake, surely someone else will now come forward. Keith hadn't made it. He didn't know anything about it. Again, nothing. Absolute silence. And this went on, and Sam Tilley, you know, kept quiet about it. In 2006, I was informed that Sam Tilley and his partner, his business partner, were involved in making a movie about their exploits, and with a British company backed by Warner Brothers. And hey presto, out of the blue, another gentleman came forward called Spiros Malaris. And Spiros said, I am the man who led the team that faked the alien autopsy. Now, as a young man, Spiros had been a mechanic, motor mechanic. He was also now a magician and a filmmaker. He'd done a lot of pop promos and all that kind of thing. And again, didn't work for Sam Tilley, he had worked with him. And he met Sam Tilley back quite by chance. And Sam Tilley showed him what was the tent footage. And Spiros said, well, that's a fake, you know. But then Sam Tilley concocted this story of how he you know, he'd allegedly bought film and it was rubbish. So Spiros said, well, I'll make it for you. And he was with good friends with a sculptor by the name of John Humphreys. Now, John had also worked in film and television. And together they built, designed and filmed the alien autopsy. Now, I've met Spiros on several occasions, being at his home. Read his diaries of the time, seeing he made a storyboard at the time, and various other pieces of information that he has all seem to fit the bill. And I'm quietly confident that Spiros is indeed the man who led the team that faked the alien autopsy. Now, in between all this, Sam Tilley's movie came out, simply called Alien Autopsy. I don't think it's been screened in America, although I think you can buy it on DVD. It stars a British duo that we call Ant and Dec. It's Anthony McPartland and Declan Donnelly. Quite a mouthful there. But they started as child actors here. They then released a couple of pop songs. They went into presenting children's television, and now they present adult television. They do a whole host of programs here. They're hugely popular. But they played Santa Lee and his business partner, Gary Shewfield. But there was a retelling of the story now. Santilli claims, well, we actually did buy the footage, bring it home, open the canisters, and it was all completely ruined, and I'd wasted my money. So he said, in inverted commas, restored it. By restored it, it means they made it from scratch again, you know. And the movie's not that good. It's neither played straight or a comedy. It's a combination of the two. But they changed the story. And he still sticks to his guns, does Santilli, but... I'm convinced it's not the real McCoy, I'm afraid. But we use the story like this, Patricia, to show the debunkers out there that we're not all wild-eyed believers, that there are researchers that will follow a case or an incident or whatever to its bitter end, no matter how long it takes. Not knowing what that bitter end is, of course. I mean, we could have got to the stage and I could be sat here now saying, yeah, I'm convinced it's the genuine article. You know, it could have gone either way.
So you're convinced that it was a hoax?
Absolutely. I think we have more than enough evidence now to prove it was a hoax. But what I'm saying is we didn't know that. We let the evidence lead us rather than anything else. You know, as you know, Patricia, the debunkers will just say it cannot be, therefore it isn't. But instead we followed whatever the evidence had led. Unfortunately, on this occasion, it turned out to be a hoax. But... you know, I think it keeps us in good stead, to be honest.
But despite the film itself being a hoax, surely you had some amazing revelations in your research of Roswell aside from the film.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it has no detriment to the Roswell case whatsoever. I mean, none at all. In fact, when the film was finally shown on television, it's a long time back now, but in 1995... it was huge. The interest in the alien autopsy film was phenomenal. I mean, quite literally. That year, I believe, it was the best-viewed Fox documentary of its type. When it went on to video, it was the bestseller of its type, you know, that Fox had ever had, and so on. They did reruns. What it did, Patricia, it raised the whole level of interest, A, in Roswell itself, but B, in the whole UFO subject. It took it to another level. And I told you, we showed it at our conference. I mean, I had a lady the night before, or the day before, ring me from Washington and say, I want a ticket. And I said, well, there aren't any. And she said, well, I'm coming anyway. You know, and she literally got on an aeroplane and turned up at the university where we were showing it. I managed to find her a seat in the end. But such was the level of interest. We had people come from China. We had news crews there from around the world. And it brought huge revelations. And... you know, people then came out of the closet and said, well, I've seen this, I've seen that, you know, and a whole host of good information came out as a result. So it did have a very positive benefit in its own way.
Sure. All information is important in adding up to disclosure.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's another lady on there that's in the book, although she's not directly related to Roswell at all. A lady by the name of Katie Frankovic. She lives in Florida. She told us of the encounter with some beings in the lime groves near to where she used to live. Absolutely fascinating story. Broad daylight, no hypnosis, none of this kind of stuff. The interesting thing is Katie is used to be a wildlife filmmaker herself, an award-winning filmmaker. Sadly, she's in poor health now, so... her career is finished in that respect, but you know she told us of her own encounters, which were absolutely fascinating. That's just one example of you know how this film touched people. It's almost like when Whitley Strieber's book Communion came out.
That was a biggie.
Yeah, well, the picture on the front, if you remember, in the early copies that came out, just had the picture, didn't even say Communion on it.
Yeah,
and it touched so many people. This film seemed to have the same kind of effect. Just people just came out of the woodwork. And, you know, so it did have a very positive effect.
Well, the truth is that I think we're thirsting for this breakthrough. And even though we're being told that we are going to panic, polls say that 75-80% of the people out on this planet believe in ET, and that we are more than ready to get on with the discovery of all the secrets that are really timely for revelation now, and contact around the globe.
Well, the old panic button thing's been used as an excuse for a long time, hasn't it? And it doesn't hold any water, Patricia.
No, it doesn't.
It really doesn't. I mean, I've been asked that. And I said to a number of journalists, I said, OK, let's say tomorrow, for example, you pick a world leader, be it the United Nations or the President of America or, you know, the Pope or a combination thereof, go on international television and announce that, you know, you have the proverbial landing on the White House lawn. You know, it will be a great news item. Everybody will be excited. It'll be fabulous. But for me personally, I still have to go to work. I still have to pay my mortgage, you know, still have to feed, well, not the children now, they're grown up, but my grandchild and so on. So, you know, people's everyday lives will still go on, but it would be the biggest news story in the history of mankind, obviously. Yeah. But Pike, I don't think so. I really don't think so. And, you know, not at all.
No, especially now we have so much prep for it. I think people are longing for it. Even the most skeptical people are at least willing to discuss it without kicking you out of the room or worse.
Well, there's a difference, isn't there? There's a difference between skeptical and debunking. The debunkers still won't believe it no matter what, even if it lands on their own lawn.
This is true.
So, just ignore them. You know, they're not worth it. Skeptics are a totally different breed. Skeptics will say, I challenge that. I disagree with that. Show me your evidence. Show me your proof. That is fine. I give an example of skeptics, and I call them the Wright brothers, because conventional science of that day said man cannot fly in a heavier-than-air machine. And, of course, they proved them wrong. They were skeptical of that and proved them wrong. There were debunkers who still wouldn't believe them. So to be skeptical is nothing wrong with that. You know, so long as it's healthy skepticism, but the debunkers, they, you know, just put them to one side and forget about them. They're not worth bothering with at all.
Tell us a little bit about, I see in your book familiar faces like my beloved Stanton Friedman, who has been a regular guest on my show at least 3 times. In fact, when I asked Stanton this question, what do you think is going to happen when they land, Stanton? And he said, well, if we can just stop shooting at everything, it'll be okay.
Well, interestingly, I spoke to a journalist colleague of mine today, and he he's researching certain hoaxes in this country. But there was, the Ministry of Defence have just released a whole load more files here in the UK. And part of those files is a big hoax that was committed in the 1960s here in the UK. Basically, a group of students made some fake flying saucers out of plastic, about two feet across, filled them with sand, put a battery in a beeper, and placed 6 or 7 of these things across the countryside. And the police were called out and so on. So this journalist friend of mine, he contacted the Ministry of Defence and said, what would you do if this happened again today, but it wasn't a hoax, if it was the genuine article? You know, in other words, if somewhere in the countryside, you know, there was a UFO landing, it was there on the ground, and they said, well, we'd ask the local police to go out there, and we might contact the Royal Air Force. In other words, they haven't got a clue, Patricia. You know, they wouldn't know what to do. So I don't see any panic even in the realms of powers that be either. Our policemen don't carry guns anyway. We've got certain firearms units, but they would just stand there and perhaps just look at it, baffled like the rest of us.
Well, isn't the shoot to kill order in effect in the UK? It is in the United States.
It's very difficult. It's not as easy to do. I mean, our policemen don't carry guns. Each police force has an armed response unit, but that has to be called upon and requested. And it's quite a complicated task to do. So, you know, if you're driving down the motorway at 90 miles per hour and the policeman pulls you over, he won't have a gun on him at all.
But you do have so many military bases there, and I would assume that the military would be the first call would go to the military, no?
The Ministry of Defence said they would call the local police because it would be on common land. It would be on, you know, it would be on public land. They were the first instance they would call the police. That was the answer he got.
Don't you think that might be not A little exaggeration or an outright lie?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he got that writing, he got that in writing, so that'll be going in the book he's working on as well. So that was a, you can almost call it an official viewpoint, if you like. But you have to remember, as you know, us Brits were a bit of a more conservative than the Americans. So nothing would surprise me. Nothing would surprise
this
me.
This is also
all.
True. Yeah. What do you, speaking of hoaxes, what do you make of the debate, the constant debate over the crop circle hoaxes? I'm not talking about Doug and Dave, but the more recent battle that goes on, that these are man-made crop of circle makers versus the interdimensional or
the thing about the crop circles. There was a chap at Bufora with us called Paul Fuller. Paul, as a profession, was a statistician, and that takes some saying, does that? But what Paul did, he actually produced a questionnaire for a number of the farms in the areas where crop circles had appeared year in, year out. And he posted these questionnaires to the various farms. So a lot of the farms, you see, Patricia, had been farmed there, father and son, grandfather and so on.
Yes.
And whilst they didn't have any photographs, they had a number of instances where the crop circles were reported, certainly before the Second World War. And they didn't know what they were, but they just accepted them as something that happened on occasion. So there is, you know, some historical reference to the simple circles rather than anything more complicated. The problem we have today is that some of the known crop circle hoaxers, and I know some of these gentlemen, have got so good at it that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to literally decide which may be authentic and which may be fake. One example, and again, it's going back into the 1990s, and I won't mention any names because I don't want to embarrass anyone, but a group of crop circle hoaxers in the Midlands did a hoax. They actually filmed themselves doing it, and for whatever reason decided to send us the videotape of everything that was going on. It was all done in broad daylight. No one saw them. No one challenged them. They didn't say anything. They just sat back. And, of course, somebody found it, reported it to the local newspaper. It went on television. Some of the crop circle experts at the time came along and announced it as the genuine article, and weren't that best pleased when we said, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, it's a fake. And we have the video evidence here to prove it. We weren't trying to prove a point. It was just something that happened. But, you know, the crop circle fakers have got so good at it that, you know, it's very difficult. It's almost the same now, Patricia, with when you get online, you get clips of alleged UFO films, video films of UFOs here, there and everywhere. The computer imagery that people can do at home now has got so sophisticated.
Yeah.
Well, it's not impossible, but at times it's very difficult to say this piece of film's genuine or it's something that's being done on computer graphics. So that's the same kind of scenario we deal with, although, you know, on a much larger scale. But there certainly is historical precedence for crop circles, without a doubt, and it wasn't Doug and Dave.
When it comes to the crop circle maker human beings, aside, what about the many phenomenon that take place? And we've heard explanations that they've used microwave and whatever to reproduce the imploded stalks of wheat, etc. But nonetheless, we have a number of phenomenon in crop circles besides just
absolutely
the formation.
I mean, again, some of these balls of light have been seen in around these areas where crop circles have formed or are forming or you know, before and after. Even one of the crop circle fakers has gone into a crop circle and claimed, again, in inverted commas, paranormal experiences that only happened whilst in the crop circle. And he's one of I'm not going to mention any names. He's the only crop circle faker who was actually prosecuted in court for what he'd done. He only got a small fine, no big deal. But again, I have no reason to disbelieve the gentleman that paranormal experiences have taken place in these things as well. So we'll have to wait and see. But this, you know, I wouldn't rule anything out, to be perfectly honest. But it's a fascinating area of research. It really is. The puzzling thing is that Although, we look at the areas where they're mainly found in the UK, and it's in the West Country where Stonehenge and all that. But when I live in the north of England, there's only been, I think, one or two. But we have many historical, prehistoric monuments here as well, and a lot of arable farming. I would have expected to see a few more in this neck of the woods. So whatever or whoever is producing these, maybe they could do me a favour and come up this way now and again. And the ladies up here are much better looking, and the beer tastes better than this. Well.
Now that is a bias if you ever heard one. Tell us, your work is vast, and you're also the editor-in-chief of UFO Matrix, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And can you give us some insights into some of the more exciting let's say, really powerful experiences that you've personally come across, or people you've interviewed, or experiences you've personally had with regard to the
film? I became interested, seriously interested in this subject in the late 1970s. I think it was around about 1981. My father, Patricia, worked down the coal mine all his life. I was born and bred in a small little village called East Ardsley, near the city of Wakefield in West Yorkshire. And your father normally worked down the coal mine or in the local woolen mill or on the railways. That was the kind of community. Everybody knew everybody else, very small place. And I brought up with that kind of people, a pretty tough neighbourhood. Now, in 1981, just a few miles from where I live, a lady phoned me. She'd seen my telephone number in a local newspaper. And she said, you won't believe me. That were her first word, you won't believe me. She lived in a town called Normanton, which, again, was similar to where I'd been born and raised. A lot of coal miners. Her husband still worked down the coal mine. So I went to speak to her. And this lady and five of her children had actually seen a UFO land in broad daylight, just, several hundred yards from where she lived. And the children were off school. It was the summer holidays. They were playing a ball game outside. She lived in an elevated house, and there was a cul-de-sac at the end. The ball went into the air. The children saw this object in the sky. It came down at an angle, stopped in midair, and just dropped to the ground in some fields that lay adjacent to where they lived. They all excitedly run into the house and, Mum, there's something landed in the field. So she came out the front door, looked across these fields. She didn't claim it was a spaceship or a flying saucer. She just said there was this dull grey dome-shaped object. Did you ever see the film The Day the Earth Stood Still?
Yes, of course.
Looked like that, but a smaller version of that. In the field, on the ground. She didn't know what it was, so she got the children, made her way towards this. At one point, they go down a dip, and she lost sight of it. She come up the other side, and there's a fence bordering the field, and now there were several tall men in one-piece white suits with a visor.
Wow.
Instruments in their hand. The children were just excited there. She was scared, and she's trying to stop them from clambering over the fence. these tall beings apparently noticed them. They walked to the rear of this thing. It raised itself up, stopped in midair, and then shot off in the distance. Now, she wouldn't even allow me to take a photograph. She didn't want any publicity. I also spoke to one of the children's friends. He hadn't seen it, but he turned up about 15 minutes, half an hour later, and remembered, the kids were so excited about what they'd seen, So he was a kind of witness to the after effects. At no time did they call it spaceships, spacemen, aliens, whatever. So it's not only what these individuals saw, but it's the type of people they were as well, Patricia. I know it's not necessarily scientific, and but they were the type of people I'd grown up with all my life. You've
heard the earth people.
Absolutely. They call a spade, and she was either lying, or not just her, but all of them were lying, or it was the genuine article.
You didn't get to interview the children.
Oh, absolutely.
What did the children say?
Pardon?
What was the children recounting?
Well, they said exactly the same. Again, they didn't call it a spaceship or anything like that. They just said this. One of the boys who was a bit older than the others, he said it looked like a Mexican hat. It was grey in colour. It wasn't colourful like the Mexican hats. That's how he described it. And it made no sound. just to the east of this, there's a huge motorway that runs past it. There's electricity pylons in the area, so it would be difficult for a helicopter to land. But they know what helicopters look like anyway, and they make an awful noise. This was totally silent. I mean, what would a helicopter land in a field for next to a housing estate? No reason whatsoever. There's nothing there. You know, absolutely nothing there.
And what were these men doing?
Well, they seemed to have some kind of instrument in their hands, and they were waving it over the ground. And they got so close that they could even see that their hands weren't gloved hands. It was a mitten. So there was no individual finger compartments in them. And that they had boots on. And they even had big wedges, big wedges on their boots. There was a big sole on the boots, big thick things. And a visor on the front of it, because this was all one, so they didn't see any hair or eyes or anything. They were humanoid, obviously, but about 6 feet tall, 5.5 feet. And they had no idea what it was. Had she not seen my telephone number in a local newspaper, I would probably never have heard about it. I went back some years to speak to her and the children, spoke to a couple of the children because they'd then grown up. There was no change in the story. Again, we published the account, but she wouldn't allow me to use her name or anything like that. Although I do know her name, I have it on file. It's nothing secret in that respect. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that puzzles me to this very, very day.
Why?
I have no explanation for it whatsoever. Like I said, they're either all lying, and there is no reason for them to lie, or it's they're telling the truth. It was exactly as they described it. And I believe the latter of those two, quite literally. Fascinating encounter. Because of what they saw, but B, because of the type of people they were. I've grown up with these people all my life, this type of person.
Yeah.
And, you know, that speaks volumes as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, it does. I've had an experience that I rarely talk about that I'll share with you now, and that is that many years ago I was working in my office here, and suddenly the lights surged, and it was the kind of surge that it should have blown out the lights. It was hundreds of volts. It was ridiculous. It was like a stadium, and I looked up. I intuitively, instinctively yanked the plug on the computer. And they went, crash. And this went back up and crashed again. And I was like, okay, how is this possible that such extreme stadium light type of lights that would go crash completely and then go back on? So I grabbed my little dog and I ran out of the house because I never know. You never know what's going to happen. And ran out to the gate. And this was, I don't know how many meters, but significant enough that I was looking back at the house from the gate and saw this Steven Spielberg type of situation with the lights going, woo, crash, up and down, and even lights that were not on were going on. So now I live in the Italian countryside, and the people here are also salt of the earth, simple folk. So I was standing out at the gate and looking at my house, and we had just bought the house, so I was thinking, oh my God, the house is going to blow up. Please don't blow up. Not now. I was completely focused on the material aspect of my house about to be exploding when the neighbor called over the fence and said, Patricia. And I said, yeah. And my boyfriend, husband, whatever we want to call him, had told me, don't tell your neighbors about your beliefs in alien stuff because they'll lynch you. Just keep a low profile with the neighbors. So I'm sitting there looking at my house and she says, what's happening over the fence? And I couldn't see her because we have a hedge. And I said, I don't know. And she said, could it be a UFO? I said, huh? She said, the television exploded in the house. Could it be a UFO? And I said, I thought it was strange that she would immediately go there. And I said, she said, look up. And honestly, I had not looked up because I was so focused on the house. I look up. I've got the classic low cloud layer, and I'm seeing Close Encounters of the Third Type lights, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, every color of light imaginable. And I said to her, I don't think it's one. And later, we heard that in two houses nearby my house, the televisions blew out, and one of the people was hospitalized for glass in her face.
Well, the thing about that as well, Patricia, is that when you speak to the debunkers and they say it can't be, well, you know it can because you've witnessed it firsthand.
Yes. Well, isn't that the truth, though? Once you've had a mystical experience or a paranormal experience or your own astral projection out of your body, you have answers that you can never convey to anyone.
Absolutely. And you don't need any more convincing, as simple as that. But the lady I was speaking to about in the village of Normanton, because that happened so long ago, I'm going to republish that in UFO Matrix in a future volume. We're looking at that type of encounter where there's something on the ground with the entities at close proximity from different parts of the world. And so that'll be coming up in a future issue as well. And it's mind-boggling. It really is. Regarding the incident you've just had, thankfully I've had no exploding television sets. But I mentioned a gentleman earlier on called Graham Birdsall. Graham is sadly no longer with us, but he was the editor of the hugely successful magazine, simply called UFO Magazine, here in Britain. Graham died a few years ago, but back in the 1990s, from a period about the early 80s to the mid 90s. In the Yorkshire Dales, above the town of Skipton, there's a small village nearby called Carlton, and above it is moors. It's literally like Wuthering Heights, but Carlton Moor and surrounding areas were haunted by the UFO phenomenon. Now, Graham and I were on Carlton Moor one night, looking across the moors. It was pitch black, and in the valley is another village called Lothersdale. You can't see it at night because it's down in the dip. You can't see any of the village lights. But lo and behold, on the moor was a light. Now, we knew there's no buildings there or anything or roads or anything, so we thought, let's take a drive down into Lothersdale and have a look. So Graham was driving, and we're driving along. If anybody knows the Yorkshire countryside, we have what's called dry stone walls that border all the fields. Basically, the stone walls are built by the farmers, but they have no mortar in between. They're held up by their skill and gravity alone.
Sure.
Now, I don't know whether it was a dip in the road or whether it was a gap in the wall or the wall was down, but there was at one point where we're driving along. Bear in mind, this is complete darkness. There are no lights up on the moors. There's no street lights. Graham was driving, so he's concentrating on the road. We hadn't yet reached the village, but there was a dip, and I could see right up the valley where we were going, and in the sky was a huge mass of coloured lights. I've never seen the like before or since, just hung in the night sky.
That sounds familiar.
But down amongst the hillside. So from our vantage point where we'd been previously, we couldn't see it because it was down among the hills, and it was gone. It didn't go. We drove past this gap in the wall or whatever. By the time we got into the village, we drove around the village. I mean, this was the middle of the night, Patricia. The local police would have seen us and thought we were burglars or poachers or something like that. But we couldn't, because of the topography of the land, it's very difficult to see long distances around corners and what have you. And we couldn't see anything else. Now, we spent 9 days camped out on these moors and saw absolutely nothing apart from the rain and the mist. But lo and behold, when we got home, there was a message on our answering machine from somebody again down in Lothersdale. What they had seen was down in the valley below the horizon. And of course, from our vantage point, we couldn't see it. So, something did happen while we were there. We just couldn't see it. That's just the topography of the hills, I'm afraid. But I never forgot this mass of lights. There is nothing natural or rational to explain it. It was just there. It was huge.
Yeah, that's right. It's like you said, when you've had the experience, you just it's another level of knowing that defies description anyway.
Well, Graham was disappointed because he didn't see it, because he had his eyes firmly fixed on the road ahead because it was pitch black.
It was, oh, sure, right.
He was as mad as hell, I can assure you.
I can believe it. Listen, Philip, we are already out of time, believe it or not. So I want to be sure to, before we close, to be able to refer people to your work. So we start with your website, which is, and by the way, given the name of the website, you're going to have to come back on my show and talk about that, www.healingsofatlantis.com.
Yes, indeed.
And we're going to talk about Atlantis a lot. And the book is called Alien Autopsy Casebook. But there are a lot of books by Philip Mantle. So you're talking, you've been listening to Philip Mantle, UFO investigator, author, and publisher of this great magazine, UFO Matrix. Do you have any other references that you can that I can give people to?
No, I'm not the publisher of the magazine. I'm the editor.
The editor, sorry. Yes, mistake.
If anybody is interested purely in our work on the alien autopsy film, we have a website devoted to it, and it's just simply called beyondroswell.com.
Okay, so great.
Go there, and there's a whole host of material on there you can look at, plus some other bits and pieces that I've worked on and written about. It's all there as well. Enjoy.
Thank you, Philip. Thank you for coming on. Keep me posted if you get any earth-shattering, galactic-shattering news in your journey through the ET experience. We'd love to have you back on and hear it from the Thanks a lot. Okay, people, it's already time. Wow, I'll never get over how the time flies. I don't care if we know that we're in a time warp and we're headed into the no time. It still amazes me how we zip through these 1 hour programs. So my thanks to Philip. Next week I have a little turn, something unusual for this show. And I'll be talking to the media person for Lush Cosmetics. These people are doing some very good things for the planet, and I thought it warranted an introduction on my show. So we'll be talking about Lush Cosmetics, their devotion to animals, the fact that their products are vegetarian, 81% vegan and working on it. And I think it's going to be an interesting show. And please make note, as of April, I will be on every other week because I'm just too busy now to be able to come to the radio every week. So that will happen in April. Keep abreast. And that's all I've got for you today. Thanks to Philip Mantle for his wisdom and insights. And to all of you, remember, dare to think outside the box of convention and soar with the eagles in the free thought zone. This is Patricia Corey. Nanu, nanu.